Their names are Cameron Caskey, Fred Gutenberg, and Andrew Pollock. And there are hundreds of other people just like them. People affected by the massacre on Ash Wednesday in Parkland, Florida. They weren't killed in the shooting, but their kids were, or their friends, or their students. And just like us, they have all kinds of ideas about what needs to change, what laws need to be enacted, how the culture has to shift. But when they questioned their elected officials last week, almost every one of them started their question, their laments, their criticism with the same sentence. I want you to look at me. There's a lot packed into that sentence. It tells you that alongside that grief and mourning is a realization that's setting in. A realization that my particular experience, my particular grief, my particular loss really doesn't matter to everyone else. That it's possible to ignore it, to look past it, to write it off. Your experience is just that, yours. I want you to look at me as another way of saying, I want to know that my particular loss matters to you. I want you to look at me as another way of saying, I want to know that my particular loss has some significance beyond my own grieving. The situation, of course, is new. The politics, the shootings, the media, it's all new. But that painful realization, the desire for people to really look at us, to take our griefs and burdens seriously, is ancient. This week, we heard it echoed in yet another story from the Old Testament about covenant. If you take our Old Testament readings for Lent, and there are five of them, and you line them all up next to each other, you'll notice they not only have a common theme, which is God's covenants, but they have a kind of pattern to them as well. Last week, we heard the story of God's covenant after the flood, and we were told no less than five times in the reading that the covenant was between God and all flesh. Not just God and Noah, not just God and Noah's descendants, but with every living creature on the earth. And this week, God's focus gets a little tighter. The covenant isn't between God and all flesh. It's between God and Abraham and Sarah's descendants. So the old covenant still exists, but now there's a new covenant with a smaller group of people. Next week, we'll hear the story of God's covenant with the Israelites, one branch of Abraham's family. So again, the old covenant still exists, but the new one gets a little bit tighter. And it's going to get tighter and tighter until we get to Jesus. And after Easter this year, we're going to hear something remarkable about how the process starts to go the other way, about how God's covenant made flesh in Jesus starts to expand. Initially, it's present just among the disciples, the people who followed Jesus. But then it expands to people who didn't know him personally, but heard about him from people who did. And pretty soon, it's not just Jews in the community, but Gentiles. And eventually, the gospel becomes something not for a select few, but something for everyone. A covenant relationship that's been opened up to all flesh. So if you're a visual learner and you want to imagine how this looks in your head, imagine an hourglass that's been tipped over on its side. God makes increasingly narrow promises so that a broader group of people will be invited into the covenant. The promises we hear about this Lent get increasingly narrow, increasingly limited, increasingly specific, but only so they can be just as inclusive, just as all-encompassing, and just as welcoming. All five of the covenants we'll hear about this season are different in their own ways, but when you read them one after the other, a certain logic starts to emerge. When God makes a covenant, God uses the particular for the sake of the universal. In today's reading from Genesis, we heard the story of God's covenant with Abraham. And most commentators will tell you that the covenant involves two things. And both of those things show up in today's reading. The first thing God promises Abraham is descendants. That God will make Abraham the ancestor of a multitude of nations. And the second thing God promises is land. I'll give to you and your offspring after you, God says, the land where you are now an alien, all the land of Canaan. And those two things are important because they always seem like they're in jeopardy. Abraham would live to 175, and he's 99 in today's reading, so he's having something of a midlife crisis here. When God first promises Moses the land of Canaan, Moses leaves to go from his home and settle there. And it isn't long before a famine strikes and he has to leave. So is God actually going to give them this land or not? When God promises Abraham and Sarah descendants, the proposition seems ludicrous because they're both in their 90s. When God tells Abraham that Sarah will give him a child, Abraham's reaction is not to say thank you or wonder at God's majesty. Abraham falls on the ground laughing. Is God actually going to give them descendants or not? But there's a third part of that blessing that usually gets overlooked. Something else that God promises Abraham besides land and descendants. Something that's more important. God promises that Abraham will be a blessing to the people who come after him. In one of their first conversations, God says that in you, Abraham, all the families of the earth will be blessed. And today God repeats that, saying, I will be God not only to you, but to your offspring after you. In you, God says, countless other people will be blessed. Abraham is blessed by God so he can be a blessing to others. The covenant that God makes with Abraham is not just a covenant with Abraham. It's a covenant with significance beyond his own life. The land and the descendants are all perfectly fine and good, but they're really there to ensure that third part, the public part, the relational part. They're there so that Abraham can be a blessing to others. This is why Jews, Christians, and Muslims all consider Abraham to be the father of our faiths, because we're all spiritual descendants of the promise that God made to him. In Abraham, God uses the particular for the sake of the universal. Now, to be sure, this isn't the way that most of us are used to thinking. So many of us view our relationships with God not as communal, not as shared, not as involving other people, but as private. And so, no surprise, we're much more comfortable going the other way, using the universal for the sake of the particular. To believe that the world exists, the blessings that God gives me exist, mostly to affirm what I already think about myself. Just get the blessing from God and keep it to yourself. Just give me the land and the descendants. I can do without the blessed to be a blessing stuff. One place you see that thinking all over the place is in our churches. George Hunsinger, whose book on the Beatitudes we read together last year, calls this kind of thinking enclave theology. Enclave theology, he says, is a theology based narrowly in a single tradition that seeks not to learn from other traditions or to enrich them, but instead to topple them and defeat them, or at least to withstand them. Enclave theology makes itself look good, at least in its own eyes, by making others look bad. Now, maybe you've had an experience with that kind of enclave theology before. A church that roots for other churches to fail. A church that's more concerned with private preservation than public witness. And if you haven't, in which case you've certainly been blessed, you've experienced that same attitude in one of its other forms. We have enclave communities. Communities that define themselves not by the values that hold them together, but by who they keep out. We practice enclave politics, politics that takes more pleasure in humiliating our opponents than in solving their problems. In so many parts of our lives, our default setting is enclave. And in so many of those enclaves that fill our lives, the vision is always the same, because the vision is always focused on the past. We build enclaves because deep down we really don't want to believe in redemption. We subscribe to enclave theology because we don't think God is actually renewing the church. We build enclave communities because we think the world is only getting worse. And we practice enclave politics because we don't trust other people to change their minds. And it would be possible to imagine Abraham's covenant with God turning into the same thing. For Abraham to have his own land and his own descendants, a little Abraham and Sarah compound. To get away from the world and enjoy their remaining 80 years in peace. But it's not about the kids. It's not about the land. It's all about the relationship, which is why God keeps on making covenants with us. Because God isn't satisfied with leaving us on our own to sort things out, and God isn't content to leave us to the worst angels of our nature. So over and over again, God uses covenants to bring us into relationship, create faith in us, and reorient us toward God's promised future. And in Jesus, God takes on our particular fears, bears our particular burdens, experiences a particular death to bring us into God's universal promise of everlasting life. Because in Jesus, God says, I love you, I forgive you, and perhaps most importantly, I see you. Amen.